you guys, just me on the movie retrospective today, because at the time that I am recording this, Tom is still sick with that food poisoning thing that I told you guys about. I'm feeling mostly better, but, you know, not all the way. But this kind of had to get recorded today. So he hasn't got out of bed all day, so I'm just like, are you gonna be able to do this? And he's like, no. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just do it by myself. You know, no big. So the movie that we're going to be talking about today, I'm so, so excited that this one finally got chosen in the poll, because this is a movie that I saw a bunch of times, you know, back probably in the early 80s, like when I was a kid, and it actually really made a big impression on me. And I hadn't seen it for a really, really long time, at least 20 years or more. And I feel like it's one that kind of gets forgotten about. It doesn't really get talked about all that much, except in the sense of, you know, the controversy that it caused, I guess. But this is the 1976 film, The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane. Now, this is, I'm not sure what genre I would call this. It's nominally like a thriller mystery type of thing. Has some horror elements. I think it did win a Saturn Award for Best Horror Movie that year. So it does have that going for it too. Almost like a little bit of a character study. It's really weird because I think that the first time that I saw it, and I could be totally remembering this wrong, I probably should have looked it up, but it reminded me a lot of this book. I think it was Ian McEwan. I think it was called The Cement Garden. Was that not about like a bunch of kids whose parents had died or they had killed them? I can't remember. And they were trying to like fake their parents still being alive so people wouldn't fuck with them so they could stay in their house. So they had put the bodies like in this big trunk or something like that they filled with cement. I don't remember. But that made a big impression on me too. And this movie is kind of along the same lines. All right. So as I said, this movie came out in 1976. It was directed by Nicholas Gessner, who is Hungarian born, but from what I could determine from his Wikipedia page, has made almost exclusively French films. He worked in France most of his life. And this was also a French-Canadian co-production. They shot it in Canada and, you know, they got the tax shelter and everything. And then they got money from the French government as well. Now it's based on a novel that was called the same thing, which came out in 1974. Now the novel was written by Laird Koenig. And I haven't read the book. I do want to get a little bit into, but from, you know, I've read summaries of it, so I do want to get into a little bit of, you know, maybe the differences. But I think what initially ended up happening was that Laird Koenig actually wrote this first as a screenplay. And then he shortly became to realize, he's like, well, there's no way that I could have like a little girl who's supposed to be 12 or 13 years old, like an actress, playing this role night after night. You know what I mean? If it was a, you know, a play that was long running or whatever, he's like, I couldn't ask anybody to do that. So I guess his agent said, why don't you turn it into a novel? So he turned it into a novel and then turned it into a screenplay. He also wrote the screenplay for this. Now, most famously, this was probably the first starring role of Jodie Foster. Now, she was 13 when she made this. As she is in the movie, she's playing the age that she is in the movie. Now, she had been in some movies before this, obviously. She had been in Freaky Friday. She'd been in, you know, some TV and stuff. I think she was acting from a very young age, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and had done like TV and commercials and shit like that. I think that she came to the attention of the producers of this film after they saw her in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, where she wasn't a starring role, but she was, you know, kind of a big part of that story. And they're like, yeah, that's her. Apparently she didn't even need to audition for the role or anything, because they're just like, yeah, that's who we want. Because basically what they needed for this particular role in The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane is a girl who, you know, was basically a tween, but who was believably very intelligent and resourceful way beyond her years. Also like a little bit cold and calculating, but not in an off-putting way, if that makes any sense. And so she is like perfect in this. And honestly, I had forgotten, like watching this movie again, it's on Amazon Prime by the way, it was on Hulu, because that's where I was scrolling through Hulu and I was like, oh man, they've got that. And that's why I put it in the poll. But then when I went to actually watch it, it wasn't there anymore. So, but luckily it's still on Amazon Prime, or at least, you know, it is at this recording. So if you want to watch it, you can go check it out. Although I'm going to spoil it, so you know what I mean. But I feel bad doing that, but the movie's so old that I don't know. I just kind of feel like maybe a lot of people haven't seen it. And this is one movie that I think it's kind of good to go into it not really knowing what's going on. Although maybe audiences nowadays would be a lot more savvy and they'd be able to figure out what's going on. I don't know. So this is Jodie Foster's probably her first starring role. The same year she actually did Taxi Driver, which I think she even got an Oscar for, an Oscar nomination. And she was in Bugsy Malone. So she had like five movies like come out in 1976, but I think this was maybe the first one to come out and the first one with her in the starring role. And as I mentioned before, you can really tell that this screenplay was originally written as a play because a lot of the scenes, probably like 95% of the scenes, take place inside the house and, you know, in the front room, mostly like the living room of the house. There's a few scenes outside and everything like that. And usually there's only two or three characters interacting at a time. And I'm not even saying that like to be denigrating or anything like that. I think it works really well because it has this really cool like atmosphere, I guess, that a lot of those movies had back in the 70s, just this kind of like creepy, what the fuck is going on type of thing. All right, so let's get into what this movie is about. So Jodie Foster plays a 13-year-old girl named Wren Jacobs. Now, apparently, to all appearances, her and her father, Lester, have recently moved. I believe she says it was 2 months prior. Have recently moved to this little town. Like I said, they shot it in Canada, but I think it's supposed to be somewhere in Maine, like a fictional town in Maine or something, somewhere up in the Northeast. So her and her dad have moved into this house. The dad has paid the lease for 3 years for them to stay in this house. Now, at the very beginning of the movie, Rin, Jodie Foster's character, is making a birthday cake for herself, and there's no one else in the house. Now, somebody comes to the door, and you find out that it's Halloween, but because her and her father have lived in England, they don't really celebrate it over there, or they didn't back then. So she's like, yeah, I don't really celebrate that, but it is my birthday and I'm celebrating my birthday. Now, the person that's at the door is this dude named Hallett. And he is played by Martin Sheen, and he is fucking creepy McPerverson. I mean, just right out the gate. I mean, he doesn't even hardly make any bones about it. He's just kind of like, hey, I'm gonna come in your house and like start fucking creeping on you. Is that okay? Okay, here I am. So yeah, he plays a really good villain in this. He just totally leans into it. Because I will say that there's some real uncomfortable because she's only 13 years old. The character is 13, and the actual actress had just turned 13 when she made this movie. So there's some kind of like uncomfortable shit in here, but I think it works. I don't think it bothers me so much just because Jodie Foster is so self-possessed and she doesn't come across, she looks like a kid, but she doesn't come across like a kid, I guess. And she comes across almost like she has the upper hand, not in a kind of femme fatale kind of way, but just in a way that she's kind of smarter than everyone else. So I guess you know that she, you know, might win out in the end, even though people are kind of trying to victimize her. You know what I mean? I'm not sure if that's real clear. But yeah, so there's this creepy dude, and he just keeps coming around, and finally she's just like, he's like, oh, my kids are out trick-or-treating, and you know, they need some candy or whatever. And she's like, well, I don't have any candy, I don't celebrate Halloween. So she's like, well, they can have a couple pieces of my birthday cake here, fuck off. So he fucks off. Now, it turns out that Creepy McCreeperson is the son of this horrible, shrewish woman, Mrs. Hallett, who is the person that Wren's dad rented this house from for 3 years. And this woman, right at the beginning of the movie, is starting to suspect that maybe something not entirely kosher is going on in this house because every time she goes over there, like, you know, the dad paid 3 years in advance, like for this house, so they could live there, but she hasn't really seen him since then. And every time she comes over there, like to talk to him, Rin's like, oh, he's in New York, or he's in his study, or he can't be disturbed, or something. She always has some excuse as to like why nobody can see him. And they also show her going about doing, I guess, what would be considered like adult errands, you know, like she goes to the bank and she's got all these traveler's checks and she's cashing them in, and the bankers are like, man, she's like 13 years old. And she's like, yeah, but me and my dad have a joint account. It's like, he said that I could put my signature on it. So she does all that kind of, she has a safety deposit box and like all this other kind of stuff. So, you know, this whole time you're sitting there going, what the fuck, man, with this kid? I mean, it's pretty apparent right from the beginning, which I think is why everyone starts to get suspicious, that she's living in this house by herself, but nobody really knows what happened to the dad or what the fuck is going on or anything like that. Now, at one point, the bitchy woman, Mrs. Hallett, comes over there and she's kind of really... The thing about it is that, yes, I realize, I don't know if she owns this house and she's leasing it to them or if she's just a real estate agent. I wasn't real clear on that. Because if she's just a real estate agent, she really does. She doesn't knock or anything. She just like lets herself in. She just comes on in and she's like, hey, I need to talk to your dad. Like, I'm like, excuse me. This is like my fucking, okay. And Jodie Foster is not having it either. She's like, this is my house. It's like, you can't just fucking waltz in here whenever the fuck you want to. I mean, she doesn't say that, but that's what she meant. So this woman, she is again trying to see Rin's dad. She, you know, she's like, he's either not here or he's sleeping, or so she always has some excuse, like I said. And so this woman is like, god damn it, I'm gonna report you to the school board because you don't go to school and something weird's going on here and I don't like it. And then she's like, I want to do my canning for the year or whatever. And she's like, and I left all these mason jars, like jelly glasses, like down in the cellar, and I'm gonna go get them. Now at this point, Rin's like, no, you cannot go down to the cellar. So you're like, oh, well, obviously there's something going on down there. Now, what ended up happening here is that Mrs. Hallett goes down to the cellar. She's like, well, fuck you, I'm going down there anyway. And goes down there anyway, sees something down there, which you don't see, screams, tries to run out the cellar, and then knocks, there's like a, you know, like a stick, like holding the cellar door up. And she knocks it off and kills her full self, basically. Like, it hits her in the head and she falls down into the cellar. At which point, Rin's kind of like, well, shit. No big loss. I'll say that, because that woman was like a shrieking harridan. And I was just kind of like, oh, well, should have knocked. But that's all I'm saying. But so Rin's like, well, shit, now what am I going to do? Because her car is out front and everybody knows, this is a very small town and everybody knows who this bitch is. So she's like, well, crap. She has this very distinctive green Bentley, and now it's parked in front of this car, or parked in front of the house. Now, the house is, like, pretty remote, but as I said, it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody's business. So she's like, well, I'm going to have to move this Bentley. I'm going to have to, like, I don't know, push to the bottom of a lake or something like that. So she goes out there, and she tries to get it started, and she can't get it started. And, like, while she's out there kind of, like, you know, flooding the engine or whatever it is she's doing, this kid rides by on a bike. Now, this kid is Mario. I'm not sure how old he's supposed to be. Looks considerably older than her, but he does say, I don't see you in school. So I'm assuming that he's supposed to be like 16 or 17. So it's not that weird that they, spoiler alert, end up kind of boyfriend and girlfriend. But, you know, and especially cause she's wise beyond her years, I guess, but he's still supposed to be like a junior high or high school kid. So he's, a magician. And I guess he says something about, like, all his brothers and being, like, athletic, but he had polio, so he's, you know, he has, like, a gimpy leg. Like, he can't really walk. He walks with a cane. So he's basically, like, he comes up to help her. He's like, well, you want me to help you move the car? And he's like, and he knows whose car it is. And they kind of start hanging out together. Now, it takes a while because Rin, as a character, is very, I mean, they get into it a little bit later on in some of the discussions that she has with Mario, but she's a very, very independent person. She does not like anyone telling her what to do. She doesn't want anyone like constraining her movements. She doesn't want to go to school because she calls it quote unquote stultifying, which I thought was very funny. And like I said, coming from Jodie Foster, even a 13-year-old Jodie Foster, you totally buy it because she is just so adult-like, even when she was 13 years old, that I didn't have any trouble at all believing that she was probably okay, like, taking care of herself, like, living by herself in this house. So, as her and Mario kind of get closer, a little bit of a romance develops there, she kind of starts taking him into her confidence. Now, what she says is that, basically, her dad was, who was a kind of a well-known poet, I guess. And he had some kind of terminal disease, I'm assuming cancer. And he knew that he was dying. And he also knew how extraordinary his daughter Rin was and was confident that she would be able to take care of herself. So basically what he did was he's like, well, we have to move somewhere where nobody knows who we are. That's kind of like this small town or remote town where nobody will really ask any questions or know us all that well. He got the house. He paid for it 3 years in advance so she would be able to live there. And basically told her, you know, just don't. He told her, just survive. Don't let him fuck you around. Don't let anybody tell you what to do. You just do what you want, and I think you're going to be okay. So then he, like, wanders off and, like, jumps in the ocean or something like that. So he killed himself. Rin did not kill him. However, let's not let Rin off the hook too quickly. Because one other thing that the dad said before he died... Now, Rin's mom was abusive, and the dad was like, well, you know, when she finds out that I'm dead and that you're by yourself, she's going to come and try to get you. So if that happens, he's like, give her some tea with this sedative in it. Take care of the problem. Now, it's not made real clear whether Rin actually knew it was a sedative or whether it was cyanide, which it was. I'm inclined to think that she probably had an inkling. She wasn't dumb. So, indeed, the mother does turn up. This is not shown. This happened, like, before the events of the movie. So I guess the mom turns up. Rin gives her the poison tea. She dies. And Rin, after doing some research at the library, embalms the body, psycho style, and puts her down in the cellar, which was what Mrs. Hallett saw when she went down to the cellar. She saw an embalmed fucking body down there. She screamed, and then, like, she fell on her, you know, the door fell on her head. So she tells Mario all of this, and then Mario, little Mr. Accessory after the fact, he decides he's gonna help her because they've fallen in love at this point. So they're like, well, obviously people are gonna start getting suspicious. We can't have all these fucking bodies piling up in the cellar. So they take both the bodies, the embalmed one and, the bitch's body, and bury them kind of outside, like in the mud or whatever. Now, sadly, what happens then is that while they're burying the bodies, there's a really bad storm and it's really cold. Mario ends up getting a cold, and from that cold, he ends up getting pneumonia. So he doesn't die or anything like that, but he does kind of have to go to the hospital, so he's kind of out of the picture. Now, when this happens... Martin Sheen's character, the creep face, has been perving around pretty much this whole time. He's been, like, stalking Rin, and he thinks he knows what's going on. He knows there's something suspicious. He wants to get in her pants. He's, like, super, super creepy. And he's good at it, which is disturbing. And this was, like, before Apocalypse Now. This was kind of, he'd been in some stuff prior to this, Martin Sheen, but I think this was kind of one of his first big major roles, and he just chews that scenery, man. He's clearly enjoying being a perverted villain, which I'm not sure how to feel about that. But yeah. So he's been creeping around this whole time. And I guess, like, after Mario has to go to the hospital and then Rin is kind of left all alone again without her partner in crime, he decides he's going to come back and check out the cellar, like, while she's out or whatever, and he's going to see what's going on. Now, the bodies aren't in the cellar anymore. However, he does find one of his mom's very distinctive hairpins, and he finds, like, a broken bright red fingernail, which wasn't his mom's, but belonged to Rin's mom. So he assumes that there was at least two bodies, because he's not dumb either. So he assumed that there was at least two bodies down there. So he's trying to use this as leverage against Rin. He's like, hey, why don't you be my little underage sex toy, says the pedo, and I won't tell anybody about your little murderous proclivities. How about that? And she's kind of like, you know, like I said, you know this character, like, throughout this whole movie, it's like, you know that she's gonna end up besting this motherfucker just because he's so sleazy and creepy and everything. And throughout this whole thing, Rin's character, the only time you see her show any emotion, really, is when, one, the motherfucker, Martin Sheen, kills her fucking hamster, Gordon, in a really horrific scene. Obviously, they didn't kill a real hamster. But they did like fuck with the dead one, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a scene where he's got Gordon in his hand, like, oh, isn't it? And that's real. But then they kind of cut away a little bit, and then he puts out a cigarette like on the head of a hamster, and it's a dead one that they got from like a lab or something. So if you're very uncomfortable with animal cruelty, you might, even though the animal's dead, it's like, it's still kind of upsetting to watch. I mean, I found it very upsetting because that was a cute ass hamster. But yeah, so, but the Gordon, the hamster, was okay at the time too, because I think a member of the crew, after the movie shoot was over, Gordon got adopted by one of the members of the crew, so it's fine. But yeah, so if that's going to bother you, then yeah, you don't want to watch that. But yeah, so she shows emotion then, because she obviously loved that little hamster, and like, to have this fucking psycho like kill the hamster like right in front of her to try to get information out of her, fucked up. And honestly, I would argue anybody that did something like that, I'm like, I really don't feel bad about what she does to him at the end. You know, I'm just saying. But so yeah, so she gets upset about that. But the only other time she shows any emotion whatsoever is when she visits Mario in the hospital. He's unconscious. You know, he's got pneumonia, and she admits to him, as much as she tried to do everything by herself, and you know, she was up, like I said, she's always very self-possessed and tried to do everything alone all the time. She's kind of crying and saying to his like unconscious face that, you know, I can't do it alone. I can't do it without you. You know, cause she loved him and he was helping her out. Yeah. So she's just like this very, I hesitate to use the word cold. She's just very resolute. She's very determined, and she's very certain that she's not going to let others, as I said, victimize her, even though she's a kid. It's really, this movie is almost kind of like a treatise on children's rights, because she does kind of say a lot of things along those lines during this movie. It's like, oh, just because I'm 13, you can just bust in my house and, you know, do whatever you want, like go down in my cellar and shit like that. So she does say a lot of things about that, like that just because she's 13 doesn't mean you can just like walk all over her. You know what I mean? So in that way, she's kind of like a really relatable character, even though she does kill people. But like I said, you know, she killed her mom, which you're hearing it from her and her dad's perspective. So maybe that wasn't, maybe she didn't know it was poison, although I suspect she probably did. She didn't kill Mrs. Hallett. Mrs. Hallett killed her own self, like accidentally. She did hide the body. Okay. Now, Martin Sheen's character, she does kill that motherfucker, but he killed a hamster and he's a creepo perv. So fuck him. Pretty much. So basically, so what he does at the end, like I said, he finds out like all he finds this stuff in her cellar and is, you know, assumes that he has killed, because obviously he knows his mother was missing, and they found her car just parked in front of the office and nobody knows where she went to, because that's where they left her car. So he's basically using that as blackmail material to get her to, like I said, be his underage sex toy, which gross. So she kind of pretends like she's going to go along with it. Like, yeah, okay, I guess so, blah, blah, blah. And then she goes in the kitchen and starts making some tea. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, it's fucking cyanide payback time. Now, she even does something clever, because she knows that Martin Sheen will figure out that she's probably going to poison his ass. So she puts the poison in her cup, Princess Bride style. You know what I mean? So she puts it in her cup. She brings out the tray and everything, and, you know, and she's all like, yeah, we're going to take it. He's like, why aren't you drinking it? And she's like, oh, I'll drink it, you know. But then, like, he's like, no, I'm going to switch the cups. And then she's probably like, yes, but she doesn't say that. Because I think he thinks that he's smarter than her, but he's not smarter than her. But, so she ends up poisoning him. And, I guess you gotta give him something, because he's like creeping on her right to the end, like right as he's dying, and he's just like, oh shit, she poisoned me. And he's like, your hair is so pretty, and like all this other stuff. I'm like, that's determination, like sticking to the perv, like right to the end. I guess that's something. And, but the final shot is so great, because it's just like Jodie Foster. It's just kind of a close up of her face looking very impassively at him. Like, as he's poisoned to death and he's, like, choking and stuff. And I'm just like, yeah, get that fucker. But yeah, now I will say, from what I've heard, and like I said, I haven't read the book, but I read several reviews of it that kind of went over the plot a little bit. Now, I think in the book, Rin was less sympathetic of a character, because I think in the book, she actually not only killed her mom, like I think in the same way that she killed her in the movie, but I think she also deliberately killed Mrs. Hallett, which even if she had in the movie, I'd be like, nah, she was a bitch too. It's like, you know what I mean? I wouldn't have felt all that bad. You know what I mean? But I think she deliberately killed her in the book. So I think in the movie, they tried to make her a little bit more of a sympathetic character rather than, you know, a demon child or whatever. But, you know, I don't know. It doesn't come across. It's really weird because I think it usually gets lumped in with a lot of other kind of killer kid sort of movies. But she doesn't come across like that at all. She does come across as very calculating and very, you know, hey, don't get my way. Like, don't fuck with me. Like, don't get in my way or something bad will happen to you. But not in any malicious way. She's not malignantly killing people. She wants to maintain her life. She wants to live alone in this house, just like her dad wanted for her. And anybody that interferes with that, she's going to do something about it. That's kind of all that, you know what I mean? So that's kind of all that's going on there. Now, when I mentioned very early at the beginning of the review that there was a controversy about this, and perhaps it's more of a controversy, I guess, in American film as opposed to European film, because like I said, this is a Hungarian-born director who mostly worked in France, and European movies tend not to have as much, they tend not to get as upset about large age differences or about things like that. So there is a scene in this movie where Jodie Foster's character, Rin, where her and Mario, her boyfriend, who is, I don't know, like I said, I don't know how much older he's supposed to be than her. She's 13. He's still in school, obviously, but, you know, so I guess that's not as weird, but it's still kind of weird because she's so young, but it's not like he's 30 or anything like that. He's supposed to be a high school kid. So the scene where both of them have sex. Now, they don't show, it's not a graphic sex scene or anything like that, but they do show the character of Rin taking her clothes off, and you see her from the back, naked, and you kind of see, like, the silhouette, like, of her boob and stuff like that. Now, don't be alarmed, that was not actually Jodie Foster, obviously, they couldn't do that. It was actually her older sister, Connie, who stood in for her as a body double and for other things on some of her other movies as well. Connie was, I believe, either 19 or 21 when this movie was shot. So it's a little weird, like, seeing this scene where what's supposed to be a 13-year-old girl, and then, like, you see this back of a naked woman that's clearly older. So it's a little strange. Now, I think that Jodie Foster, from what I've heard, she really, really argued to have this scene taken out because she was like, it doesn't really need to be in there. It's just kind of like weird and creepy. And I think that many years later, she sort of disowned this movie, particularly because they wouldn't take it out. The producers, for whatever reason, I mean, I'm sure I can think of probably what the reason is, but they did not want to take the scene out. And indeed, it is still in there. Even if you watch the Amazon Prime version, I think there are some versions where it's been cut out, but if you watch it on Amazon Prime, it's still there. Like I said, it's not graphic. It's not anything like that. It's just like the back of a naked woman that is clearly not Jodie Foster. It's her sister who was of age at the time. So it's not like there's a naked 13-year-old girl in it. I will say that even though I don't find it, you know, all that scandalous, it probably didn't need to be in there. It's just a very throwaway. It's only like a few seconds, 30 seconds, a minute or something, like before she gets into bed with Mario. So I don't really know why it had to be in there. So I can kind of see why Jodie Foster was mad, because it kind of embarrassed her. She was only 13 at the time. And, you know, she was like, I don't know, you know, please take it out. But they wouldn't take it out. So like I said, she kind of doesn't really, you know, fuck with this movie anymore. But, you know, your mileage may vary. I'm just telling you that that's in there. So if that's going to bother you, or the animal cruelty thing is going to bother you with the hamster, then maybe not. But other than that, I really, really like this movie. There's just something so creepy, I don't know, like about the atmosphere of it. And Jodie Foster is fucking amazing in it. I mean, you can really see, I mean, she was amazing in Taxi Driver. She was amazing in all this, you know, everybody knew what an amazing actress she was when she was, even when she was very, very young. It was very apparent. But she just brought something to this role that was just like, it was perfect. It was just like a perfect, like I said, you totally bought not only that she was a 13-year-old kid, which she was, but she came across as just so adult and so mature that you also totally bought that she could do all this shit, that she could totally live by herself, that she could, you know, just sort her own life out, because she just really seemed to have her shit together, like more than some adults I know, even nowadays, you know what I mean? So it's like, so the fact that she could pull that off, I think it's like a tour de force performance, because it's, I mean, most of the movie revolves around her. There are some other characters and she interacts with other characters quite a bit. You know, there's a cop that she befriends also, who is Mario's uncle, who's actually really nice to her. You know, and the creep and the bitch and everything. But I mean, this is mostly her movie. You know, Martin Sheen, probably the second biggest role. And I guess the guy that played Mario, probably the third biggest, but it really is kind of, you know, the whole movie kind of rests on her shoulders, and, you know, and her acting performance really, really makes this work. So yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's from 1976, as I said. It's a, you know, don't go into it expecting like a horror movie. It's not scary. It's more unsettling in a way that a lot of, it kind of gives me the same vibe as like The Other, which we also talked about from 1972. It's just this real, I don't know, there's just this real off-putting, like unsettling, eerie kind of vibe to it. And there's like, you know, a mystery about, you know, it feels like something sinister is always going on and you're not entirely sure what. So it's just like a really, really good atmosphere like that, which I think a lot of movies from that era have, which is probably why I like a lot of them so much. But yeah, this is definitely one to check out if you haven't seen it. Like I said, it's a little bit of a forgotten movie, and Jodie Foster doesn't really like to talk about it anymore. And like I said, I can't entirely blame her. I get where she's coming from with that, but It is a really great acting performance. It's a really cool little story, little mystery, you know, and definitely one I would recommend. So if you have Amazon Prime, it is on there, at least as of this recording. It used to be on Hulu. I don't think it is anymore, sadly, but I'm sure you can get it somewhere else if you want to see it. And that will do it for this movie retrospective. Hopefully Tom will be back for the next one, and I'll see you next time. Bye.